Welcome to Pax Europiana, and this is obviously the week for enlargement, so it's a big week for me. It's the week of the 1st of May, where always there is the anniversary of the EU enlargement, and I really want to celebrate it this year here on the podcast. It's, of course, an innovation. I didn't have a podcast before 2021. YouTube channel, I just released a video. But what I would like to really do now is explain various aspects why enlargement was such a success story. It is today as well, and it is also to be, because obviously I'm supporting the EU enlargement to be continued, the 9 new countries to join, Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, from the Eastern Partnership to be upgraded EU potential candidate countries, and also to join NATO, to adopt the euro. That's obviously the way I propose it, to do it faster than previously, because we have also no time to lose. And it has worked so well in the last enlargement rounds from 2004 to 2013, the 13 new countries, Croatia, Romania, Bulgaria. And we should repeat it. Also with Kosovo, Bosnia, Serbia, and of course, fast with the NATO members, Albania, North Macedonia, Montenegro. I have released now a podcast about the economic aspects, but I will now go through the moral, the historic, the human, the infrastructure, the political, the defense, the strategic, the global, the environmental, the energy, the market, and again, the social and economic dimensions. Because in all dimensions, it's really very good. It is the moral right thing to do. It is the reasonable, rational, and responsible thing to do. And all enemies of enlargement, all people who are against enlargement, I'm confident they were already against enlargement in 2004, and they are basically the enemies of Europe and my enemies in the short term. Who is against enlargement, I declare here openly, is my enemy. And I will fight against all these people who impose enlargement here, not with military means, I'm not planning a revolution. I will talk against them. Who is here on my podcast, on my YouTube channel, in my other Twitter, LinkedIn, and whatever, I openly declare here, these are immoral people, irresponsible and irrational people. These are the blockers, the enemies of enlargement, are the enemies of Europe and of me and of the enlargement countries and ultimately of their own citizens, because it's a through and through positive process. It's a fair and serious thing to do to support enlargement. I had just had an interesting Twitter debate about the economic and social aspects, because today in Bulgaria, according to this Bulgarian journalist, he has just posted it, 25% of the people in Bulgaria live below the per person capita income line of 230 euros monthly income, available disposable money, and they are officially poor. And then Valerie Hopkins has made a tweet, yeah, already more than a decade in the EU, and still 25% of the people in Bulgaria live below the official poverty line. Oh, how bad. Yes, and it is bad. I'm also very much in favor that people live better in Bulgaria. And Bulgaria today is the poorest country of the European Union, as all the journalists tend to repeat. Yes, and by the way, I was in Bulgaria in 96 and in 2000, that's the number I use now as reference, Bulgaria was at $1,600 GDP per capita. Now it's at 10,000. That's 6.5 times better in 20 years. What we exactly expect to happen? How much should the GDP increase in a country like Bulgaria within 20 years, where Bulgaria is just 14 years now in the European Union, and we have already, I think, 4 crises in these 14 years, or if you want to count 5 crises, fine as well, from migration to great financial crisis, to corona crisis, to the Greek debt crisis, and nevertheless, the GDP has 6.5 times is higher in Bulgaria than it was 20 years ago. I mean, of course, there's poor people in Bulgaria, and it's on the lowest level of the European ladder. Yes, but for example, Moldova is just at $4,000 per GDP, and so is Kosovo. Yes, there's also Ukraine, which is also at $4,500. You know, the situation is that Bulgaria and Romania is, and Georgia, Bulgaria is, you know, more than double as good as Ukraine, Moldova, Kosovo. So what exactly should be the result of a new enlargement, if not 6.5 times improvement towards their own status quo 20 years ago, and double the result in prosperity than all other countries around, which were not so lucky to be inside the European Union, which also received massive help. I think it's quite obvious. And imagine one time how many poor people and how poor they would be if Bulgaria would not have been taken in 2007 into the European Union. Yes, we would have much more poverty like we have today in Moldova or in Kosovo or in Ukraine. But we had the wisdom to include Bulgaria. And true, it's not perfect. Yes, but where are the reasons? And did Europe invest massively in Bulgarian infrastructure as Mrs. Palacio has proposed in the 1990s? Did we do this generous reconstruction of infrastructure like the Germans have done for Eastern Germany? No, we didn't do that. No, it was impossible for us to be so generous. Or did we really build the European level institutions for the rule of law and the justice in a hierarchical way, like a European FBI, like a real European public prosecutor with also line authorities over the Bulgarian public prosecutor? Or didn't we care because we don't want to concede these powers from Germany and Austria to the European level? So obviously they don't exist for Bulgaria as well. And Mr. Barroso found it very convenient to have the complete control over the public prosecutor, learning from Putin how to do this so-called JICA system. If you don't know what is Mr. JICA, in a short word, that was for more than a decade the prosecutor general of the Russian Federation under complete control of Putin, who exploited his position from working with the mafia and has done terrible things. Please see Mr. Navalny's videos for Mr. JICA and his really half a billion hotel project in Thessaloniki with the widow of the mafia boss of southern Russia. This kind of style of advice Mr. Borisov then took, and then he has controlled the judiciary for his own purposes, and we just watched on. Of course, we did some CFM mechanism, but just for the EU-funded projects. Yeah? So we have not built the Europe we all dreamt about it in the 2000s, because we didn't want to pull so much power up on the European level, we the Western Europeans. And then the Eastern Europeans, new potentates, they have exploited our weaknesses in the construction of Europe. And then we have, of course, not the same result like we have it in other countries. Other countries have, of course, also caught up quite well. It's not good maybe to mention Malta and Slovakia, because there was also significant backsliding. Yes, and all this backsliding happened because the center was too weak, because we didn't build the Europe that it needs. We didn't build the European judiciary institutions because France and Germany could not agree to build up this European powerful central institutions, which we need, of course, we need them so clearly, like in the United States. Yes, you can complain 25% of poverty in Bulgaria is, of course, not a great result. Yes, and it's not good. Yeah, I don't defend it. But imagine one moment what would happen if Bulgaria would not be in the European Union and how poor the people would be then. Because also in Bulgaria, there are quite a lot of rich people now. There's also good infrastructure now. There is a lot of people who live in a decent middle-class life. Despite this JICA-style prosecutor and despite all the things, Bulgarian situation is relatively well-developed. I know several, you know, there's even Bulgarian businessmen in Austria, investors, you know, it's not exactly that Bulgaria is today a poor country in all dimensions, like it would be if it would have stayed outside of the European Union, and that's the key question. Of course, things could have gone much better as well, like they have gone in Lithuania and Estonia and Latvia as wonderful examples. They have already joined the Eurozone. They have digitalized. They don't have problems with the rule of law. They are Northern Europeans. They have always been. They have, of course, cleaned up their institutions. And they are, of course, culturally less prone to this kind of authoritarian kind of Balkan style situation, because also they had always this big neighbor of Russia. They wanted to be away. They wanted to be a Nordic country. There was a different national consensus towards the West than in these countries in the Balkans, where basically small power elites had always the possibility to somehow corner the political market. And then we have, of course, less progress. And that's why Bulgaria is only half as rich as the Baltic countries. Yeah, true. But it's also because we didn't really help as much as we could. And given the conditions, again, I repeat it, they were obviously already much better in the Baltic countries. These were the most developed regions of the Soviet Union. And also in the years, in the interwars here, there was already some kind of civil and also physical infrastructure when the Baltic countries were free. In Bulgaria, because of the Ottoman times and also the difficult first years, this was not exactly the boom time, the interwar years. And also there was much more destruction there in the second. There was all over Eastern Europe. I don't want to say there was more or less destruction, because there was, of course, a complete disaster. Nevertheless, you know, the starting point was different. We have achieved a lot. But don't let me track this whole podcast only to defend the success of enlargement. I want to also raise the point about the historic dimension of the whole project. I mean, this is what we built the EU for. This is the founding fathers. This is the mission. This is the historic reason why there is a European unification process from Jean Monnet onwards. Peace for the Europeans, prosperity American style. This is what they have envisioned back at that time. Obviously, it was impossible to include the Eastern Europeans. But the rest, the Western Europeans, the Southern Europeans, this was the reason why Greece and Spain and Portugal were taken in after they turned back to democracies after their fascist times. This is obviously the task as well, to overcome these communist divisions and the wounds of the past, from all this terrible totalitarian past. And this is why we have Europe. That's the historic. And if you want also the moral dimension, I mean, you cannot exclude some because you don't like them, you don't think they are rich enough, or they don't fit in your religious, ethnic, and other dimensions, which you have maybe prejudices. It is the moral dimension of our values. Excluding anybody is not possible. Of course, you know, they have to fulfill certain criteria, but it doesn't have to be to protect against whatever the Muslim Albanians or the Serbs you don't like, or whatever the Ukrainians which you think they are owned by the Russians. No. If you think like that, you shouldn't be in European responsibility, media, academia. No. That's really wrong. We have this moral obligation to unite and to include, and obviously to help with standards. Yes, no doubt about it. Obviously this is included, but not to put the standard so high that's impossible to reach for the poorer countries, because then it's simply kind of a protectionist mechanism to hide the xenophobia or the non-willingness to include poorer people in some kind of nice EU regulatory terms, and to have some excuses for the unwillingness to share the same opportunities as well with the Balkans and with Ukraine. It's also a human dimension. Obviously, you know, it's very sad that 25% of the people in Bulgaria still are poor, but we have also poor people in Austria. But obviously, it's much better to be poor in a country where there is a welfare system, where there is working infrastructure, where there is opportunity, maybe, if you want and if you choose, or if you have the right to move anywhere. The poor Bulgarians, they are EU citizens. Their rights are protected. Nobody can chase them, if not Mr. Chaika II of Bulgaria. Maybe that's also a big issue, obviously. But in principle, not only in theory, they have the EU passport. Oh, for xenophobic reason, we didn't allow them in Schengen. But they have the free movement, you know. the Bulgarians have free movement. Even when they are poor, they can come to Austria if they choose so. I mean, their political rights are also protected. It's not only the council, the human rights court in Strasbourg. It's the EU law. They are equal to me, the Bulgarians. Every single Bulgarian is equal to me in front of the European institutions. I mean, that's a powerful thing we have not given to the people of Kosovo or Ukraine. And that's really wrong. And this is a very important dimension of human rights protection, of social rights protection. Obviously, you know, for now for this corona crisis, of course the Bulgarians per capita were the worst hit in Europe, among the worst hits. Yeah? You know, but what would have happened if they wouldn't be in the European Union? How bad it would have been then? Obviously, they also got now, of course, it was a bit of a mess. The ones have Astra. I actually got vaccinated with Astra today. The others don't like it. You know, everybody wants now BioNTech. Yes, okay. The management was chaotic in this election phase of Bulgaria. Yes, but nevertheless, you know, they are getting vaccinated as well. In the summer, all Bulgarians who want will also get the vaccination because they are in the EU. It makes a big difference. It will take much longer for Kosovo and for Ukraine, Moldova. Or yeah, the Serbians did also quite well. They were sneakingly working with the Chinese and the Russians. Fine for that. That's another topic. From the question of infrastructure. Look, you can say Bulgaria is not perfect, yeah? But you know, and you can say it's also poor. Yes, 25% of the people are poor. I understood the message. But doesn't it make a difference? Or maybe not. Let's understand it. Is it nicer to live in a country without infrastructure and to be poor, or with a country where in theory everything works, where you have good railway system, a good health system, where you have working highways and you have efficient infrastructure, and maybe your children, they have better opportunities. They will also go to a high school there. They will go to a university in Bulgaria. And suddenly in a growing economy, maybe they will have opportunities which were completely now not possible for the older generation of Bulgarians who in the transition maybe didn't acquire the skills or didn't really have the mobility or the wish to emigrate or whatever reasons. There may be in a transition economy, a lot of people have traumas, have lost a generation of skills, and are maybe not able for the labor market to be so integrated and so successful. That's a tragedy. Please pin it down to the communist division and ask Uncle Joe Stalin for it. Yeah? But it's not our responsibility that this generation was lost. It's very sad. I'm very sad for anybody who has to live in communism. And I'm sad, you know, the recovery was not so smooth. But let's not forget, maybe the younger brother or the children of these people from Bulgaria who live now in poverty, they have the whole infrastructure of a working EU country available. They have the highways, they have the universities, they have the business environment. And the children is maybe already an IT engineer in Germany or has also the opportunity to work in the Silicon Valley of Sofia and enjoys then a wonderful infrastructure. It makes a big difference. Obviously, Ben, maybe some people are in this policy of envy. They think it's better to be in Cuba where everybody is poor. But even in Cuba, not everybody is poor. And in Cuba, the infrastructure is not working. And in Bulgaria, it could be better. I'm sure about it. We need high-speed trains and we need all the rest of the highways and the railway system. And, you know, there's certainly many things in the health system in Bulgaria, which are not on the German standards. I understand it fully. But nevertheless, much has improved from 2000. And would anything have been better if we kept Bulgaria waiting like Kosovo or like Ukraine? Have you been in Moldova? Have you been in Albania? Would anybody like to change and put Bulgaria back in the level of Macedonia now? It's the double the prosperity of Macedonia. I mean, let's be serious. Enlargement and inclusion is much better for the Bulgarians. And it really worked and it delivered. If it has not delivered fully, okay, let's do more. Let's invest more in Bulgaria. The political dimension. Obviously, it's extremely hard to somehow see that we would not include Bulgaria, Romania, our country. what's our moral legitimation to call us European Union? If we say, then we have to call us Western European Union. Maybe rich, white, Western European, excluding Eastern Europe. I mean, it has a big political dimension also for our legitimacy on the global stage to promote the European project as a somehow a role model for ASEAN, for Africa, for Latin America, for other regions, maybe also to work peacefully together. After all the disasters we gave to the world, the First World War, the Second World War, fascism and communism, all European political projects, yeah, which led to so many millions of people dying, and we exported it to the world. Now we export the European Union regulatory standards and this kind of concept of peaceful reunification economically, politically. And when we then exclude countries, how serious can we be then? It's the same issue I have also with these people who ask for a global role of the euro. While we are not able to give it to the Ukrainians or to have it successfully, not even convince the Hungarians and the Poles to join the Eurozone or anybody else to adopt it. But then some in Brussels and Frankfurt talk about the global role of the euro. I mean, how serious will anybody in Africa and Asia take us when we are not ready to include the Balkans? Or when we now discuss Bulgarian membership was a mistake, and when you then say this to an African Union official, how serious will he take you when you say, you have to do the European Union, we are a very big success model? Man, please, we also have to think that the others are not silly. They also know where Bulgaria is, they also know Ukraine, you know. They are in Addis Ababa, they are also reading the English news about what's happening. So let's be serious, yeah. So, defense and strategic issues. I mean, obviously, that's also very important, and it was a consideration, obviously, in 2004, and it must be in 2024. The defense dimension, NATO, the security, the strategic unity. It's not only about, you know, the question of who is in NATO, that's, of course, very important. Also about the strategic interconnectivity. That means how fast mobility can be done by tanks and by military units, in case they are needed further in the East. It's very important. Once the physical infrastructure is on European level, of course, you know, troops can move very fast in case ever they would be needed. But I don't hope. I'm here in the peace project, Pax Europiana, but it's important to make it clear. And defense and strategy issue of a unification process has obviously also the important aspect that once we are more successful, more united, obviously our opponents and our enemies take us more seriously, because we are more serious. European Union now of 450 million, and that's a significant number of people. If you are then united, you have also a budget, you have some institutions, then also the Russians take you serious. The Russians take NATO very seriously, because they take America very seriously. If we want to be taken seriously, we have to be more united. The number of people matters, the budgets matter, the institutions matters, and then also China and Russia and other countries in the world, but mostly them, also India, also Japan, everybody in the world will take Europe more serious if we have the next enlargement seriously successfully completed. And obviously, if now our officials see, you have a lot of countries, you don't know what to do, you don't like them so much, you talk negatively about your own members, that will not make a global good impression in New York or in New Delhi or anywhere in Beijing or in Moscow. The more united we are, the more seriously we'll be taken also. And it's a question of global responsibility, a question of the global role of the European Union, and of the significance of the European project in the global level as a role model, but also that our values, our ideas, our projects, our people get elected, they also get taken seriously, our opinions, our matters, whatever we have from climate change, which I think is not the overriding priority. It's, of course, strategic security and economics, which matter most. Yeah? But, okay, it's also a very important point. Yeah? And if we want to be the global champions of climate change, then we have to be taken seriously economically, strategically as well. Otherwise, the others will think we are NGO representative. So that's very important as well. And it has also an important environmental dimension, because the way the communists have treated Eastern European environment, from the reckless industrialization to the low technology level to the irresponsibility with land and nature, was of course a huge disaster. And we will have to one day also face the ex-Soviet Union disaster in Russia. But still today you see that outside of the European Union and all its mechanisms to clean up the air, the industry, the water system and the earth and all the other legacy issues of the past, but also of the present in terms of energy, it matters hugely if you are inside or outside of the European Union. The EU has cleaned up all this from the Baltics to Bulgaria. All this industrial legacy and disasters of communism cleaned up in the last 30 years. Work half done, you can say. There is much to be done. Yes, but already significant things have been done. And the EU has all this regulatory mechanism and enforcement mechanism. And now it's important to include also the other countries to clean up the remaining mess of the communist disaster legacy inherited from their reckless industrialization policy and also from their reckless military policy and so on and so on. So many issues. And now when you see the air monitor of Europe, the worst place is obviously Bosnia, Macedonia, Serbia and obviously Ukraine. And no matter what then is hidden still in disaster in Belarus or in Russia. But when you see just, you know, this part of European Union and future accession countries, you see the countries outside obviously by far behind in air quality, water quality, recycling, waste collection, earth quality, in all parameters. Because we exclude them. They have to work with their own money, competence and regulatory framework. It's gradually getting better, but it's of course much more complicated alone, obviously, and much more expensive and much more difficult and easier to look one eye away and to say, let's fix that later, because nobody really looks. And that's not the way we want to do business in Europe. Also about the energy situation. Obviously, we want to do this huge energy transition now away from carbon. Fine for me. I also like clean air and everything. It's not a problem. And it's also very helpful in our strategic relation with Russia. The less we buy from Russia, the better. And it's also very helpful in our and the cleaning of the cities. And, you know, I'm totally in favor to end carbon. We can afford, but we have to take also Ukraine and the Balkans along. We cannot leave them alone and then their industry cannot export to us, for example, because we put a carbon tax. That would be crazy. Or we have this thinking that they are like the dirty places, the dirty industry can move to Serbia because they don't care. And that's not the idea, I think. Yeah. So we have to get them in and also help them to fast track the energy transition. Because what's the sense to have Chernobyl just around the corner and then it explodes and all of us are also affected? That is, of course, of the Soviet past. But, you know, a similar thing can be said about air quality or water quality. What's the sense we have the cleanest part of the ocean when in Albania all the waste moves into the ocean and in Croatia you find the results? Yeah? It's not logical. It's only one Mediterranean. It's only one airspace over Europe. So we have to get everybody in. It's quite logical. And I think also when you think pan-European or continental wide of infrastructure, of the energy infrastructure, obviously, you need this pan-European dimension, and so everybody must be included who wants, you know, who doesn't want, maybe in the European Economic Area or in other form in the customs union. And in some countries, it's obviously technically, politically not possible because there is no common understanding, like in the case of Turkey and the European Union. That's very sad, but it's very much connected to both sides' political unwillingness. But that's not the case for Ukraine, for Kosovo, for Bosnia. These are all pro-European countries. They want to join, so let's get them in. And it's our moral, historic, human, infrastructure, political, defense, global, environmental, energy, social and economic responsibility and strategic priority. It makes simply sense. It is completely wrong to include country, and it's economically, strategically nonsensical. And it doesn't serve any purpose. Delaying this kind of conditionality. We blackmailed you into submission. You have to write all these papers. Anyhow, they do that. Yeah. Nobody in Eastern Europe is against taking over the regulatory things. But the enforcement obviously is very costly and complicated. So if we want this high level of standards, we have to also support them and pay for it. Where should otherwise the money come from? I mean, let's be honest. And anyhow, the contracts which we then give, for example, on infrastructure, will be done by European or international companies. It will be no fast-track train built by the Kosovo fast-track train company, because that doesn't exist. Yeah? So it will be anyhow very good for the whole economy. And also strategically to connect the whole space of Eastern Europe in the European Union makes a lot of sense for everybody in terms of transport corridors, in terms of labor force, in terms of consumer goods, in any aspect. It means better to have an enlarged European Union. And only in the racist aspect, in the xenophobic populist kind of anybody, you know, can always whip up emotions against a specific ethnic group in your political electoral system. That's always very good in Europe, because always somebody doesn't like anybody. Yeah? You can tell this. But that's actually why we built Europe, to my best knowledge. We built Europe not to do that. I think so. If, you know, the Macron thinks its enlargement was bad, then obviously he plays in the anti-Eastern European sentiment of his electorate. He's a racist. Yeah? And obviously Kurz's emotional statements from 2015, which made him chancellor, they were all, you know, this Balkan route schließen, they closed the Balkan routes, and he is doing some kind of aspects of this ever since. Is obviously meant to play with the deep-rooted sentiment of the Austrian population against everything from the Balkan and Turkey to be evil, dangerous, and difficult. Yeah. This is the truth. Yeah. It's deeply rooted sentiments against the East, which is in basically every European country is hesitant towards its Eastern or Southeastern European neighbor. From England, they are very much so against the whole of the continent, and think we are useless and have these racist, xenophobic sentiments against the whole continent, with exception maybe of Northern Europe. Northern Europe has it about the South. Yeah, the French have it about the Germans about the Eastern Europeans, the Austrians about the Balkans, and so on and so on and so on. So this is the tragic truth. And obviously these young populists in power, mean it center-left, center-right, extreme-right, obviously extreme-left, you have it in all dimensions. It's very easy to whip up the people against the neighbors. But it's, I think, not what we should do. And it's certainly very mean and evil to do. And so I think we should be better than that. I mean, if that's the Europe we want, we have to work for it. And we have to oppose those extremists and populists and this kind of xenophobes in all parties and socialist province and in economics. Yeah. They're always these protectionists. They are protecting us from enlargement, protecting us from market openings, protecting us from anybody else. But, you know, towards the big ones, in the Americans and the Russians, they are always, yes, 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 yes. But towards the smaller neighbors, they are big standing, grandstanding protectionists. Or too far away, Mercosur. Yes. Anyhow, so let's be optimistic and close on a beautiful ending. It's time to enlarge, and it's again time to do it. The success of the 2000-2004 is the proof of what I'm saying. Economically, an amazing social infrastructure, and in all aspects. Sure, we have not overcome all evils, nor all poverty, nor all kind of underdevelopment. There's much to do also inside Austria, inside Germany, inside the Netherlands. Yeah, there's much to fix. Yeah. This shouldn't wait. Yeah? But it is not true, and it's utterly wrong that first to improve Europe, or first to clean up your own house, and then to allow the others, and they have to stand in the rain and in the cold while you are sitting at the warm fire of a ready-made bed. You have your nice supper and you think, oh, once I have here everything perfect, then I will let anybody else in, and they are starving to death and freezing to death outside, while you are sitting in your nicely made, already inherited, lucky position. And then you look from time out of the window if the poor from the Balkans and from Ukraine are still around and still knocking at the door, craving to be in, and you shut the door and put a lock for in front in order not to let them in on the table. And this is not the Europe I believe in. I believe in this open, united, strong Europe I call for and I hope for and I work for. So this is what I think we all should do, and to have this enlargement, including Moldova, Ukraine, Georgia, Kosovo, Bosnia, Serbia. But first of all now, and this is the priority, to get in the next 3 years Albania, North Macedonia, Montenegro as full members of the European Union, already voting in the European Parliament 2024. And that's the way to honor the big enlargement of 2004. That's the way to celebrate our success. That's the way to show the world that we are really strong, united, and that Europe is working. Even after Brexit, we have recovered. We know what to do. And we are doing it well, and we are united, and we are open, we are attractive. Nations want to join the European project, and it's moving on towards a better future. And that's the way forward. Thanks a lot for listening. For Pax Europeana, please give me a like at my YouTube channel, also here. Subscribe on iTunes or leave a comment, that would be also helpful. And also give me a like on Facebook, on Twitter, I would appreciate. Thanks a lot for your support. Bye.